Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. It takes a lot of courage, confidence, and sometimes a leap of faith to give up a good job and a promising future to take on a new life when the prospect of success is uncertain and, in the minds of some, unlikely. Jim Zolkowski's case, it was truly a leap of faith. During travels abroad, he was dismayed by excruciating poverty and deprivation and decided to do something about it. That something was the realization that education was the key to ending poverty that led to the founding of the nonprofit Build On. Over two decades, Build On has helped build more than 500 schools around the world. In this country, he inspires inner-city youth to participate in community service programs. Jim tells his story in the book, Walk in Their Shoes, Can One Person Change the World? It was written with Clayton native James Hirsch, a best-selling author and University of Missouri Journalism School graduate. He was on this program almost 3 years ago, by the way, to talk about his book, Willie Mays, The Life and the Legend. Well, to the two Jims, welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Nice to have you with us.
Thanks, Don.
Thanks, Don.
Jim Zolkowski, let me start with you. Where were you in your life when all of this got started?
Well, I had just graduated from college, and I worked a couple jobs, saved as much money as I could, and I backpacked around the world for about a year and hitchhiked mostly and spent most of my time in developing countries. And the first country that I visited was India, and I was completely overwhelmed, as you mentioned, by the excruciating and extreme poverty and the injustice of the poverty in India. And then I went to Nepal, where the poverty index was even more severe. And I was climbing up into the mountains, trekking actually through the jungle to get to the mountains, and passed through a village where they were celebrating the opening of a school that they had built. And it was a 2-day celebration. They never went home. So I was at the tail end of that. It was an incredible, incredible experience. And I saw now not just the desperation of extreme poverty, but the hope, you know, and the courage that surrounded education. And I think a seed was planted there. I finished this trip and made it back to the States. And I saw poverty in our own country in a much different way, especially in American inner cities. And, you know, seemingly intractable problems with gang violence and all sorts of different things happening. But still that same thread of hope and courage that I saw in Nepal. So I wanted to act on all these experiences, but I chickened out and ended up taking a job with GE in corporate finance instead.
And how long did it take you before you decided that that was not the life you wanted to lead?
I worked with GE for about 15 months. And over that time, you know, I felt a growing sense of responsibility to really step up and act on these experiences and really try to align the way I was living with what I believed in. And so 15 months later, I left GE and they stripped away the safety nets and we went for it.
Yeah, that's easier said than done. Walking away is difficult enough, I'm sure. But to get started on this new path, what were some of the immediate problems that you encountered to take this new route?
Well, there were a lot of them, a lot more than I ever could have imagined before I left GE. I left GE, my younger brother and I set out to build 3 schools on 3 different continents and to set up these intensive after-school programs in urban high schools, in 3 different urban high schools. And, you know, we got going on that and were able to mobilize about 100 kids from 3 different high schools and then also establish villages through partners where we would build in Brazil, Malawi, and in Nepal. And about 3, 4, 5 months in, that was going well, but we couldn't raise a penny. We faced immense rejection from anybody we talked to, corporations, foundations, individuals. People not only said no, but gave us a host of reasons why we would fail, 4 or 5 reasons sometimes why we were going to fail. And the demoralizing part was that they were all legitimate reasons. You know, we had no experience building schools in developing countries, mobilizing communities in developing countries in a remote place, some of the most remote places on the earth, working with urban youth or fundraising or building out a strategic plan. So we were at a low point and probably the lowest point, the most challenging, at least for me, for that phase, was when we got a fax message from Malawi. And the message It was tough. It said, you know, today we announced to the village of Miss O'Malley that you're coming to build this school, and they immediately broke out in song and dance, and they weren't supposed to do that, Don. They weren't supposed to announce that we were coming until we had the funds, which we clearly did not. But the last line in the facts said, "Needless to say, if you fail to come, they'll be equally disappointed." And the key word, Don, was failure. And that was a really rough moment for me on many levels and for the organization, because we were failing and we had to dig in and figure out how to turn it around, because now we see, you know, what the consequences of failure are. Disillusioned American youth because of empty promises made by adults like me, once again, and kids from one of the poorest villages in the world or in Africa not getting a school. So we were in a tough spot.
Weren't you really making it harder on yourself by deciding to take on these projects on three different continents?
Yes. Jim asked me that question, too. I have no good reason why we decided to build three schools on why we couldn't just build three schools in one country. It just, you know, we were 24, 25 years old, and we didn't make all the right decisions early on. That was probably one of the mistakes we made.
Let me bring Jim Hirsch into this discussion. This is a little early for you, Jim Hirsch, to get into the story. When did you first pick up on what Jim Zolkowski was doing?
Well, a couple of years ago, we were introduced when Jim decided that he wanted to try to write a book about his experiences, and he needed someone like me just to help shape his story. So I met him, and I guess the thing that struck me the most, and I think about it just in hearing Jim's answers to you, is how improbable his ambitions were, and yet how idealistic he is, and how certain he was that he could achieve these things. You know, a lot of us, Don, see human suffering and we see injustice, and we may feel bad about it. Maybe some of us will write a check to an organization or volunteer a few hours in a soup kitchen to help out, but not many of us devote our lives to trying to alleviate those injustices, to try to raise people out of poverty. But that's what Jim has done his entire adult life. And so when I first heard about what he did, I was very skeptical. As you know, Don, you know, I've been a journalist and author for many years, and I tend not to believe things easily. And what Jim said he achieved, I just had a hard time believing. So I ended up going to the communities where Jim and his organization do their work, in Harlem, the South Bronx, and Detroit. And I went to Africa for a couple of weeks, and I saw what he and his group do, and I was just so impressed by it, and that's how the book came about.
How difficult is it for someone like yourself to write in the first person when the first person is somebody else?
You know, it was not hard because Jim and I spent a lot of time together, not just interviewing Jim, but just being together, traveling to these different places and talking, and ultimately a very close friendship was formed, so that I felt that I had a really good sense of his life, about what was important to him, the role that faith, for example, plays in his life, his goals for his organization. And so it really wasn't hard for me at all, because I was just so impressed by what he did, and I came to understand his experiences so well.
It's a little bit different writing a story like this than it is writing about Willie Mays, right?
Yes, true. But, you know, in their own ways, they've both achieved amazing things.
True enough. Let me backtrack to Jim Zolkowski and get back to the early part of the story. You mentioned, you're taking inner city kids as part of this project, Jim. Tell us exactly how that worked. I mean, I'm not sure that everybody understands what your process was.
Well, sure. Let me give you a more broad overview. So what we're doing at Build On is trying to address the education crisis, global education crisis. Right now in the world, there are nearly a billion people that cannot read or write. And we see direct correlation, causation between illiteracy and extreme poverty. In the United States, a high school student drops out every 26 seconds. So what we've done is set up intensive after-school programs in some of the most challenged urban high schools in the United States, where we mobilize students through a service learning curriculum to step up in their communities and to make change by working with elders and homeless people and younger children. And these same kids we take overseas to build schools in developing countries. And so at this point, you know, our youth have contributed nearly 1.2 million hours of service in Detroit and Chicago and Oakland and San Francisco and Philly, South Bronx, East New York, you know, and some of the toughest high schools and neighborhoods in the country. And we've built 587 schools in some of the economically poorest countries on the planet. And these metrics are a testament to the strength of these youth, where they're coming from, what they're capable of, and the communities. Because each school that we build in a developing country, the villagers contribute all the unskilled labor to build those schools.
But one thing I want to be sure that our audience understands that on many occasions, you take kids from these inner city locations you're talking about and take them overseas to help in the actual physical building process.
We do. We do. We absolutely do. And Jim and I went with a team of kids from the South Bronx to Malawi, Africa. And you know, there's 18 kids on this team. I go quite frequently, but Jim and I, for the research for the book, went to a very remote village in Malawi and witnessed alongside these urban youth, the community coming together for this enormous meeting. And there was a celebration, and then we got down to business, and we asked everybody in the village to sign a covenant. And the covenant outlines their commitment to contributing all the labor, which is about close to 2,000 volunteer work days to build the school, and sending their daughters to school in equal numbers with their sons. And so we all get ready to sign the covenant. It takes 4 hours, Don, to sign the covenant, because very few people in the village can actually sign their name. All they can do is add their thumbprints. This woman signed the covenant, and I was standing next to her, and then she stood up, and she had to thumbprint the covenant, and she was proud, and she looked at me, and she said, you know, my name is Felicia. I'm 86 years old, and I had 11 children. Only 4 of them survived, but I got grandchildren. And then she put her hand on her heart, and she said, I can die in peace knowing that my grandchildren have a school and a future. And right next to us on the other side is this kid named Jimmy Arzu, who lives in the projects in the South Bronx, a former gang member, was in the gang virtually until we went on this trip. And, you know, it's incredible to see the interconnection. Jimmy had lost his mother, you know, and was orphaned. And he comes out and meets people like Felicia, works side by side with him to build these schools. His life is completely transformed. The kid has gone on to contribute over 200 hours of service. He's a freshman in college. He beat the odds. He graduated high school on time. It's an amazing, amazing thing to behold.
Boy, it's a double whammy you're delivering then, Jim, when you help the people in these far-off lands and then help people right here at home to live a more productive life than might otherwise have been the case. I have to take a break. We'll do that now. Jim Zolkowski is my guest. He's the author, co-author, I should say, of the book Walk in Their Shoes, Can One Person Change the World? He's talking about his organization Build On and the work that it's done around the world. His co-author is James Hirsch. He is a native of Clayton, Missouri, by the way. He joins us by phone. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Jim Zolkowski, you mentioned a couple of things I'd like to pick up on when we come back. I'd also like to invite members of our listening audience to get into this conversation. Perhaps what you've heard so far inspires you. We'd love to hear from you at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you prefer to send a tweet, do so at STL on air. Back with the two Jims in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation. We're talking about the book, Walk in Their Shoes, Can One Person Change the World? It's the story of Jim Zolkowski. He lived that life over the last 20 years or so, helping poor people around the world establish education as their means out of poverty. As I say, he lived the life. Also with us is James Hirsch. He's a Clayton native, and he helped Jim Zolkowski write about that story. But before we continue that conversation, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Missouri lawmakers are starting a special legislative session today that Governor Jay Nixon called in hopes of persuading the Boeing company to build its 777X jet plane right here in Missouri. People trying to win a spot on the March primary ballot in Illinois have just a few hours left to file their petitions. The deadline is 5 o'clock today. More than 400 candidates have filed so far, including candidates for governor, the state legislature, and Congress. And St. Louis is about to turn 250, and several events are planned for the big anniversary. Today, organizers of a group known as STL 250 announced celebration plans. St. Louis Public Radio's Kate Essig was on hand for the announcement and will give us an update a little bit later in this program. You can hear more about these stories and more this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day on stlpublicradio.org. Now back to the two Jims. That would be Jim Zielkowski and Jim Hirsch, talking about the book Walk in Their Shoes. Jim Hirsch, let me come back to you. You were there during this very poignant and dramatic moment that the other Jim mentioned before the break. What were your impressions of what was going on?
Really just one of amazement. When you think about where we were in this very remote village in Africa, impossible to find. It's not like there's a road that leads up to it. You kind of have to make your own road, and I recall clearly the group of kids from the South Bronx and Jim and I and a couple other staff members. We were in this bus. It was a long ride to get to the village, and as we are riding out there, the kids from this village see the bus, and there's actually like four or five villages around there, and they start chasing after us because they knew we were coming, and they knew what the purpose of our visit was. And they start chasing the bus, and they're screaming, and they're dancing, and they're singing. The bus finally stops, and there's this huge celebration. And the kids from the South Bronx are just overwhelmed by all this emotion. And as they get off the bus and are embraced, literally, by the kids, they're starting to cry because they just can't believe all the love that is shown for them. And to me, it was just like a scene out of a Spielberg movie where you're in this Africa, in these Africa plains, and you're just embraced by this strange community. But it was just so powerful, and obviously that's why Jim does what he does.
Watching the transformation of the kids from South Bronx must have been really quite remarkable. I mean, you've already indicated that, but to see them change from the life that they had come from to the new life that was emerging for them must have been quite something.
Well, and that's the amazing thing about the organization. The first time I met Jim, as I mentioned, I was kind of skeptical about whether his organization can really do what he says, because the perception of kids in the inner city, whether it's in St. Louis or any city in the country, is that this is kind of the forgotten population of our country, and these are problems that cannot be solved, and we just kind of manage them. And Jim says, no, that's not the case. These kids want to not just do well in their community, but they want to stay there, and they want to make it better. And when I asked Jim, well, what makes you so confident about this? And he said to me, these kids have hope, and that's all the fuel we need. And the more time that I spent with the kids from Detroit and Harlem and the South Bronx, the more I knew the truth of that statement.
Jim Zielkowski, what sort of follow-up is there? I'm thinking of this in a couple of directions, not only the kids you brought over from the South Bronx and others, but in terms of the villages and these very remote areas that we've been talking about. Once the school is built, isn't there a temptation on the part of these kids who are finally educated and literate when their parents are not to leave the village?
I think there is that temptation. What we do, though, is mobilize communities. The parents of these children build those schools. They form leadership committees of six women and six men. They make the decisions, and they are absolutely have a stake in the project. When we finish building the school, we have partnerships with different ministries of education, local ministries of education. They provide the teachers. And at this point, there are 85,000 children, parents, and grandparents attending these schools every day. And you know, as I mentioned, parents and grandparents, they're going to school at night. They're learning how to read and write, like Felicia, the woman that I mentioned earlier. And so we've seen massive improvements in gender balance in these communities. And we've also seen improvements in economic self-sufficiency, a lot more microenterprise taking place in the community, outside the community. We've seen improvements in sanitation and health. And we've seen improvements in agricultural productivity. And we've not just documented this ourselves. We've gotten outside evaluators to take a look and tell us what's working. And again, it's their ownership. So, yeah, there's the temptation for children who become educated to leave the community. And maybe some of them do. A lot of them do. But a lot of them stay because their communities change, because education has such an impact. It changes the trajectory of the future for these villages. So it's very powerful to see.
It has to be. It has to be. I want to pick up on the gender situation here because you make much of it in your book, and I have a line here from it. Felicia, if I have her name pronounced correctly, and maybe it was she who said, when you educate a boy, you educate one person. When you educate a girl, you educate a community and the next generation. Elaborate on that for me. What exactly does that mean?
Sure. Well, that was actually a woman named Komba Dumbia in Mali, and she is a person who I met at about 10 p.m. In one of our literacy classes, and it was to the light of these oil lanterns, and it's standing room only in here, and these parents and grandparents, she told me she's a 55-year-old woman, and she has grandchildren in the school, and I found out she has two granddaughters attending the school. And I know how hard it is for girls to make it into school. So I said, you must be very proud. And now here you are learning to read and write. She said, I'm proud, but I'm also ashamed. And I asked her, why would you be ashamed? You know, and it was a naive question for a guy who's spent 20 years doing this. But she looked me in the eye and she said, you know, I've spent my life living in the darkness of illiteracy. You know, I found out that she was refused education as a little girl. She was subjected to female genital mutilation. She was married to a man she never met, forced into a child marriage at the age of 15, became one of three wives. Three out of five of her kids didn't make it, passed away. She just experienced all this pain and sorrow in her life, but she kept going. She just steps up to join the leadership committee in her village. And then she's in this literacy class when I first met her. And, you know, I got to know her pretty well. I kept going back to see her because she had so much wisdom. The last time I saw her, she had been elected to a really important role, the most prominent woman in the region, and she also became the leader of all the women in the village. She outlawed female genital mutilation, and she had brought substantial development to the community, specifically with microenterprise. And she told me, she said it couldn't have happened without education, And she, you know, to close the loop, you know, I asked her why she was proud, because she said she was mostly ashamed but partially proud. And she said, I'm proud because now I'm living in the light and my granddaughters are living in the light, you know. And so, you know, there's just so much gender discrimination, so many challenging circumstances that our communities work through, especially girls and women. It is perhaps the most inspiring part of what we do to see them rise up the way Komba Dumbia did and the way her children are.
Jim Hirsch, let me come back to you. I'm going to shift gears a little bit here because I certainly want to get this into the discussion. We're all familiar with the problems that Greg Mortensen had, the author of Three Cups of Tea. He, too, had a ghostwriter or a co-author. This is something I suspect might have crossed your mind as you got involved in this project. I mean, how are you sure? How are you sure when you take on an assignment like this that you're getting the true story?
Well, that's a very good question. And in fact, the Mortensen's the Mortensen problems just came to light right when I met Jim. So even if that hadn't been on my mind, it certainly was because of the timing. And the answer, Don, was just that I did my research. As I've already mentioned, you know, I didn't just hear about Jim's story from Jim. I went to these communities and I spoke to the children in these schools, these teens in Harlem and South Bronx and Detroit. And I went to Malawi for 2 weeks, and I participated. I was there building a school with Jim and his organization, and I interviewed members of Jim's board, and I interviewed other staff members and people who have been part of the organization. So I had to, be very careful for all the obvious reasons, because I didn't want to have happen what happened to Mortensen's ghostwriter. But, you know, to me, it was just a piece of the whole project, which is that there's something so, as I said, idealistic about what Jim does. And so, you know, it's hard to believe, really, that the only way you can believe it is to see it. And then even when you see it, you still kind of shake your head in disbelief, because literally these kids' lives are transformed. And so so just by doing that kind of homework assured me 100% that everything Jim has said and done is true.
Jim Zolkowski, did the Mortensen thing have any impact on your work?
It did. It did. Ultimately, I think that we're better because of it. And, you know, I was asked to comment on this from the Wall Street Journal, a bunch of different publications when the story broke. And I think that the lesson we learn from what happened with Greg Mortensen and Three Cups of Tea is that we've got to do our homework, that all of us as donors, stakeholders, the audience, the reading audience, they have to have a stake in it. And, you know, it build on. We're going to build 100 schools this year, 130 schools next year. We break ground on a new one every 4 days. More than 60%, close to 70% of all those schools will have stakeholders, donors, students working side by side with villagers to build those schools. So I encourage you to go out, you know, and when you're contributing to an organization, to an NGO or a not-for-profit, go out and see what they're doing, experience it, work with the people. And if you can't do that, then check out their financial statements. Look at their metrics. Look at their outside evaluations. And really due diligence on what's happening inside and outside that organization and the work that they do. Because when you do that, organizations become better. And when they become better, the children are served. People like Komba Dumbia, people like Jimmy Arzu, people like Felicia, they are benefited. They are impacted by more scrutiny and work done by the stakeholders.
You obviously have solved the funding problem that emerged at the very beginning of this process.
Thankfully, yes.
Yeah. Who is contributing? Is it the man and woman on the street, or major corporations, or both?
Combination, Don. We have, you know, lots of folks that give us small but extremely meaningful gifts of $10, $50, $100, and then we get contributions from multinational corporations. GE is a big supporter, believe it or not. In fact, the treasurer and the CFO are on our national board of GE. They've been fantastic. We just solidified a really wonderful partnership with Ogilvy and Mather, and we get tremendous support from the corporate community. We also run special events around the country where folks from each of the communities where we work step up and get involved and help us to align the resources we need to run our programs in all those cities and to build the schools overseas. So it's a great combination of support that we get from people, from foundations, corporations, and really through special events.
What does it cost typically to build a school in a remote place, whether it be in Africa or Asia or Latin America?
Well, we can build a school that'll educate about 150 children per year, and it's designed to be there for at least 100 years for $32,000 in almost any of the countries. We work in Nicaragua, Haiti, Mali, Malawi, Senegal, and in Nepal. And we're able to do that because the communities donate the land. They contribute the unskilled labor. We bring in the materials, the resources, the engineering, and they lead the project. And the reason so many people are attending those schools, we're at or above capacity in all the schools that we've built around the world, is because they own those projects. So it works out well.
Well, yeah. Jim Hirsch, how is this experience of yours, both living it as you did to the extent that you did, and then writing about it as you did, how has it changed you?
I think it's just made me a lot more hopeful that what we consider to be intractable problems, namely poverty and low education, low expectations in the inner cities of our country and in villages around the world, those problems are not intractable. They can be solved. The only thing that Jim and other organizations like his need are resources, because Jim has the methodology down. I mean, they know what to do to make this work, and so the things that I saw just made me so much more encouraged. And that, part of that spark that is what, drives Jim each day, I think that rubbed off on me.
I have to take another break. I'm going to do that now. We'll come back and continue our conversation with Jim Zolkowski and James Hirsch. They are the co-authors of the book Walk in Their Shoes, Can One Person Change the World? And Jim Zolkowski has spent the last 20 years, a little bit more than that actually, going around the world to some of its most remote regions. And he's helping to build schools for these very, very poor, poor people, claiming that education is the path that will lead them out of poverty. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. And again, we'd like to bring you into it at 382-8255. Give us a call or send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with the two Jims, Jim Zolkowski and Jim Hirsch, co-authors of the book Walk in Their Shoes, Can One Person Change the World? Jim Zolkowski, I'd like to come back to you, because in reading your book, And your description of the various places in the world where you have been, Asia, Africa, and Latin America, are there various gradations of poverty? Does poverty have a single face or a single look, or is it different in these different places?
Well, I think it's different everywhere you go. And poverty in Haiti looks much different than it does in West Africa. And when you look at the United Nations Index on Human Poverty, Mali is in much more dire circumstances. They're like the fourth or fifth poorest country on the planet, where Haiti is the poorest in the Western Hemisphere, but the poverty doesn't really compare in terms of that poverty index. Yet Haiti's pounded by three or four or five hurricanes every year, which devastates communities, especially rural villagers. They were impacted by, I think, the worst earthquake in the history, recorded history, where over 250,000 people lost their lives in 2010 because of this one single natural disaster. Yet the thing that is the same about the people in Mali and Malawi and Nepal and Haiti and Nicaragua is that they have that determination, that grit, that refusal to quit. And if you give them a chance through education, you will see that they will rise up. Don, we've talked a lot about what's going on around the world. That same grit is happening in Detroit, Michigan, the economically poorest city in the United States, and we see it every day. I'd love to talk about that for a minute if we have some time.
By all means, go at it. Give us your perspective on that.
Well, I'm from Michigan, so I'm definitely all about the Motor City. And there's one particular person that Jim and I wrote about, and her name is Rhea Gatti. And she's a kid I met for the first time in a shelter for homeless veterans in Detroit, Michigan. And I was watching, we were preparing meals and serving meals. I was watching the way she connected and interacted with these guys, these vets that were homeless in Detroit. And it just come back, a lot of them from Afghanistan and Iraq, pretty tough characters, who've been through a lot. And yet she was so graceful, and she was able to lift them up and get them to smile. And I said to her, how do you do that? How do you connect with these guys so authentically? Kid's 15 years old when I met her, right? And she says, these guys gave me my smile back. And I was like, okay, so did you lose your smile? And I ended up, getting to know Rhea and her family quite well. And it turns out that Rhea was never closer to anybody than her older brother, Vandell, This guy took her to school every day. He took her to do service. He was the one that always took her out to celebrate her birthday. Every year it was Vandell. And about 4 weeks before Rhea's 15th birthday, Vandell was shot down by an AK-47 and killed. Mm. And Rhea was just devastated. And, could barely function, And then when her birthday came around, she knew that she couldn't celebrate without Vandell and didn't think she'd ever be able to do it again. And then she decided that she was going to, instead of celebrating, go and do a day of service in honor of Vandell. And that's the first time she went to the Detroit Vet Center. That's the first time she connected with those vets. She went in there expecting to help them. They lifted her up. They saw the sorrow in her eyes and in her heart, and they helped her to process that pain. And she never stopped going back. She's contributed over 700 hours of service. She went on to build a school in Nicaragua, which we later dedicated to Vandell. And now she's a sophomore at Bowling Green State University. She's an honor student, full scholarship for the service that she's done. This is a kid that represents the spirit of Detroit and the spirit of our youth and the strength and the capacity that they have to make change. So I'm actually very optimistic about Detroit. I'm optimistic about the South Bronx, East New York, and we got to get to St. Louis.
I'll tell you. Well, and I think Jim Hirsch can probably bear me out on this. We could use a little help here, too, in some of the ways that you're talking about.
Well, and Don, just to make sure it's clear what Jim's group does, there are a lot of organizations in the country that come to schools with various kinds of enrichment programs where the kids can play sports or do the arts or music, fun things that kids of all backgrounds enjoy. That's not what Jim's group does. They come to schools and say, what you really need to do is public service. It's not about giving you something. It's about what you, as a teenager, can give back to the community. And that's what I was so skeptical about. Why would kids want to do that? Wouldn't they rather, go and play sports or do arts and crafts or whatever? And Jim says, no. What kids want to do is help out in public service. And then, as Jim just described with Rhea, he's right. That's what kids do want to do. And I saw it with my own eyes. I went to those soup kitchens and to various places, with the kids. It's just so meaningful for them. And I think a lot of us don't appreciate the power of public service, but that's really the cornerstone of Jim's entire operation.
That's so encouraging for all of us to hear, no question. I have a caller I'd like to bring into this discussion. Chris is going to join us from Glen Carbon in Illinois. Chris, thanks for waiting. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, Don, my wife and I were both involved in programs similar to what you're discussing. We were in the teacher corps in the late 60s, and she was in Peace Corps in Africa in 1964 in Niger.
Wow.
There's an article in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch on Friday entitled, Poor Are Wary of Health Program. I'm curious whether or not Jim might see a connection with his young teenage after-school people to help poor people who have difficulties in doing the administrivia related to getting enrolled in the Affordable Care Act programs. In other words, to get health insurance or get to enrolled in Medicaid. The article talks about problems that the poor people have in getting to the site that they need to fill out. They have problems in getting valid birth certificates. And it would seem that maybe there's a connection with your youth program to help poor people in their neighborhoods to get enrolled
Chris,
in
let's
Medicaid.
Let's see if they have a position on that. I think it's slightly off point, but perhaps not. Jim Zolkowski, what do you think?
Well, I don't know the ins and outs of the Affordable Care Act and
well,
how it's working.
Don't.
Exactly. But I can. The caller asked a good question, and I'm certain that they're going to face challenges like all Americans in navigating the bureaucracy. Though I think it's a very, very important piece of legislation, and we do need to bring health care to the least fortunate in our communities. We have seen, though, our kids navigate the bureaucracies of getting into college, getting financial aid, getting scholarships, getting loans. And when motivated, they can do it. They can accomplish it. And I'm sure that their families can do the same things with the Affordable Care Act. I should add, too, that, you know, we're working in schools where the graduation rates are 50% and lower. Yet the kids that we work with not only graduate high school, but 94% of them go on to college. You know, Ray Agati is not alone. You know, and so that gives me hope and inspiration that there is nothing that these students and their families can't do. I've never met a kid that's wanted to escape from their neighborhood or is looking for a ticket out, man. They want to turn it around, and let's watch. We'll see them do it.
Jim Hirsch, is it possible to come out of an experience like this and not be optimistic about today's young people, particularly the group, the demographic that we're talking about?
No, it's not possible. I think if people read the book, they will see that anything in your community or any other community is indeed possible. I think there's a frustration level with the politicians and the media and others who sort of disregard low-income communities. All the talk and rhetoric is about, well, we have to work for the middle class. And yes, we do, but we shouldn't forget about the entire community. I think that's the power of Jim's program.
Jim, you spent, Zalikowski, you spent an awful lot of time over the last 20 years away from home, traveling to these various parts of the world. How much of a burden was that on you and your family?
Well, I did most of the travel before we had children, and so I don't travel as extensively as I used to overseas. And you know, but it's tough. I do go to Africa. I'm headed to Burkina Faso in a couple of months. I'm on my way today to San Francisco and then to Detroit. And it's challenging on the family. But my wife is just completely invested in what we're doing and believes so strongly in it. And my children, I spend a lot of time with them, quality time. When I'm not working, I'm with the kids. And so I'm very fortunate to have work that I believe so strongly in and to have such a loving and supportive family that I just, you know, I thank God every day for these blessings.
Just one final question before we have to say goodbye. You mentioned the family, and I'm aware through your book of your son Jack, who has had some health problems. Also aware that what got you started on this path that you've been on for the last 20-plus years is the deep and abiding faith that you have. Does your son's medical condition, has it ever called you to question your faith? Was it a test of your faith in any way?
Ooh, that's a good question, Don. Just so the audience knows, 3 years ago, my son walked into the first day of first grade and collapsed from a massive tonic-clonic seizure. And within hours, we were in intensive care and quarantined, and the doctors didn't think he'd survive, that he would live. And then when he did pull through, they didn't think he'd ever walk or talk again. You know, and by the grace of God, he's in the third grade. He's got some challenging learning disabilities, and he's on some very difficult anti-seizure meds that cause a lot of side effects. But this kid doesn't quit. He keeps going. He is just the embodiment of courage and tenacity. So during the darkest moments there, you know, I a lot of people wondered whether, you know, I would question my faith and be angry with God. And I've had people ask me that. And absolutely not. You know, those are the times where I found the strength of my faith and that my faith lifted me up. Those aren't the times where I questioned my faith so much as I relied on my faith. And it was there, and I know that faith is a gift. And I'm grateful for it because it's gotten me through that very difficult time, probably the toughest time of my life, and many other challenging circumstances. Now, Don, before we sign off,
which we have to do in about 30 seconds.
Okay, I got a shout out to Jim Hirsch. This guy, it was a long shot that he would co-write that. He is not my ghostwriter. He's my co-writer. This guy's name is on the book because he's a best-selling writer, wrote for the New York Times, Wall Street Journal. I didn't think I had a chance, and you know what, of getting Jim to help me with this project. We sat down for a few hours, and it was because only because of Jim Hirsch that I agreed to write this book in first person, that I agreed to tell my story. I was deeply concerned about, you know, the it becoming about a person instead of a cause, but because of the respect, the friendship, and the love that I experienced with Jim Hirsch and that I have for him right now, we were able to write this book. So, Jim, God bless you. Thank you for being there and for working through this with me. It was an amazing experience because of you.
We're going to have to leave it there, Jim. I'm sure you're grateful to hear those words, Jim Hirsch, that is. I want to thank you both so much for being with us. The book is Walk in Their Shoes, Can One Person Change the World? My guests, Jim Zolkowski and Jim Hirsch. Thank you both so much for being with us. Congratulations on what you've been doing, what you've done, and congratulations on the book. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Don.